Hey, it's Brian. Before we start today's podcast episode with Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute, let's talk about the master's program at the University of Dubuque. If you've been considering getting a master's with a foundation in business, but an emphasis in sports, the Master's in Management Sports Management at the University of Dubuque could be your perfect mix. I've long stated my personal preference is for a master's in sports management to be rooted in business, since that's the language of our world. Sports is just another big business, but in a much cooler package, if you ask me. Well, the University of Dubuque program offers face-to-face or online options and is just a 30-credit-hour program rooted in business. This whole thing can be completed in 1 year. The curriculum is focused on building leaders in the sports world and includes integrated field experience and professional development opportunities, which means you're going to get the experience that employers want. You're going to learn a lot of great stuff in the classroom, you're going to apply it out in the workforce, and you're going to be attractive to employers. That's the mix. Check out the University of Dubuque's program by visiting dbq.edu/mmsm. One more time, dbq.edu/mmsm. SM. Now, let's start the countdown.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hi everybody, I'm Brian Clapp, Director of Content for WorkInSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports Podcast. Sometimes we behave like sports is settled science. Athletes play games, fans buy tickets and t-shirts, coaches coach, trainers nurture, businesses buy suites and entertain clients. It's the circle of sports. But in reality, there is much more than that going on in the business of sports. Sure, we all still care about the box score of last night's game. We want to know why Kawhi Leonard is able to do what he does, how Tom Brady seems to defy the laws of aging, and understand the rise of the Minnesota Twins. But in all honesty, sometimes that stuff is the superficial part of the industry. Yes, it's the most important. Without games and achievements and stars, there wouldn't be anything else. But we should be proud that there is much more to contemplate. The sports product is more than beefcakes running fast and jumping high. There are intricacies and impacts that need to be studied and better understood. Sports is much more than just the elite. It's also the everyday. The athletes that aren't on TV still have questions that need answering, like, should your child play football with a concussion? What are the chances your child can become a pro athlete? Should you drink Gatorade instead of water? The communities who support teams have questions, like, should the public fund a new stadium in their city? And why aren't more Latina girls participating in sports? These are the questions that are inspired by the actions we all watch. It brings out so much more information we want to know, we yearn to understand. These are the types of questions that the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University sets out to solve through research. But this isn't the type of research that gets passed around from scholar to scholar, never making a real impact. It's the type that is filtered down into the communities and to the people that need it the most. One of the massive advantages of the Global Sports Institute is that it works cross-functionally with other departments at Arizona State, from engineering to sociology to the athletic department and beyond. That's how they achieve the real depth of knowledge and game-changing research abilities. At the head of this program is Global Sport Institute CEO and this week's guest, Kenneth Shropshire. It's funny, I'm 44 years old, so I don't generally refer to people as Mr. or Mrs. that often. I usually go first name, and I'm comfortable with that. But Kenneth Shropshire is a Mr. Shropshire. if you know what I mean. He's a commanding presence with a global impact over his 40 years in the sports industry. We'll get into his impressive background during the interview, but know this. If you hear me call him Kenneth at all, I was uncomfortable doing it. It's because he asked me to. I have so much reverence for this man. I kept wanting to call him Mr. Shropshire out of respect for his worldly accomplishments as they relate to race and college sports and sports agency and so much more. So many of the foundations of knowledge that we have in sports came from Kenneth Shropshire. Here he is, Mr. Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sports Institute. Hey, Kenneth, how are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
I am fantastic. I'm very excited to have this conversation because I think you're doing very interesting things at the Global Sports Institute. There's a lot. You've been long at the forefront of the discussion of race and diversity and inclusion in sports, which means we have a lot of deep subjects to dive into. But let's start out with a little bit on the Global Sport Institute and a little bit on you and your background. Economics degree from Stanford, law degree from Columbia, and then a long career in sports. What led you to make a career in sports your focus? How did you end up here?
You know, it's funny. The career in sports that I envisioned was a big part of it was in the NFL as a player.
Okay.
I wanted to be a professional athlete, and I went to Stanford on a football scholarship with that in mind. And it really was, you know, probably sophomore, junior year where I realized that wasn't going to happen. So I started looking around for other ways to stay engaged in something that I was excited about. And I mean, it was about the time, I know you've talked to Lee Steinberg before, it was around that time that agents were starting to, people trained as lawyers were starting to really play a big role in sports in a visible kind of way. So I said, I guess I'll go to law school.
Okay.
I actually, you know, it's a funny thing, a guy who's career has been kind of simultaneous with mine. Ray Anderson and I were on the team together, and Ray and I both would talk about this whole sports law agent thing as we both realized the playing wasn't going to happen. So it was that kind of transition. It was out of necessity in some ways, but it turned out to be the right move. I hadn't really thought a lot about being a lawyer, but I had thought about being involved in sport, and law ended up being the vehicle.
So you were part of the Los Angeles Olympic Organizing Committee in the 80s. You were a professor and director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. You've been a board member of multiple sports businesses. But most recently, you added to this lengthy and impressive resume by becoming the CEO of the Global Sports Institute at Arizona State. So I did a little bit of research. I'm looking through to learn a little bit more about the Global Sports Institute. And I love that you had this mission statement almost that were one of your main goals saying that you want to change the world through sport, which is honorable. But what does that mean to you, and what is your vision for the GSI and what it can accomplish?
Well, as you know, Brian, and people that look at sport, there are a lot of things out there related to sport, and we kind of hear about them here and there in terms of impactful vehicles, in terms of impactful uses of sport, and in terms of sport being better. So in this, a conversation began now many years ago with myself and President Curl here at Arizona State and Ray Anderson, the athletic director, about what could be done differently and what didn't exist with an institution of higher learning, with a university, with sport. And so we start talking about this whole idea of how do you use sport more intelligently? How do you make sure people have the information they need about sport? And it's not just a random occurrence that you find out the things that you need to know. So issues like, what are the chances your kid being a professional athlete? Should you drink Gatorade or water? Is walking as good as running? Should cities build stadiums and arenas? Is that a good use of funds? So all these kinds of issues actually reach across the university. Are wearables working for people? And we said, well, why don't we put together an institute that captures the studies and the like that are out there, that funds new studies that need to be done. And then let's also use the Cronkite School of Journalism to develop a publication that puts stuff out there in a way that people can read it and learn about it. So we're really just getting underway with that whole, you see, there's kind of an engine of things that have to happen. You got to find the research, you got to fund the research, and then you got to translate the research. So our publication, Global Sport Matters, is what's designed to do that. And in addition to kind of traditional kind of things you'd read, we're looking at infographics, podcasts, mini documentaries, videos, that sort of thing to convey the information as well. So that's what we're, you know, it's a big mission. We are being broad intentionally, with the only narrowing being that it has to be information that matters, that's impactful to somebody.
See, that concept really spoke to me because I feel so much research is done in a silo where it's published for no one to see or just echo chambered amongst other academics. And yet it doesn't always get out there to the people that need that information. But you're really, it sounds like, if I'm understanding it correctly, striving to bring research to the audiences that need it. And how effective has that been to this point?
far, it's worked well. I mean, we want it to work better. I mean, I think you got to continue to have high ambitions. As I said, we're just getting underway in terms of funding research. We've funded now 30 or so projects. Many of them are not complete yet. We've begun the publication, so you can kind of see the kinds of things that we're doing. We're also looking for partners to in terms of distribution. So we do some work now with The Guardian, with MSN, and we're talking to kind of the obvious people that are out there and hoping that they'll begin to pick up stories and the like that we have out there as we build our own distribution at the same time. So the beauty of what we're doing, I tell all my business people, I'm 30 years a business professor, and I've been involved in starting a business and that sort of thing all along the way. The beauty of being in the academy, though, is profit is not the bottom line. The bottom line is, are you putting together excellent information that's impactful? So by that measure, so far, so good. And if we can increase the impact piece, then we'll have even greater satisfaction.
So one statement I heard you emphasize in a video about the Institute was that your aim personally was to make the people in sport better, make sport better, and make the world better as a result. Again, great mission. Where do you see the greatest opportunities to live that? Where when you were looking out there at what's happening in the sports world and in the trends and in the changes that have happened over your decades in the industry, are there opportunities that stand out to you to make the people and make all these things come true?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know enough about thinking about this to say there are a lot of different ways that could be answered. There are a lot of different places that you can point to where there could be improvement and impact. But I will tell you about one that's really forefront for me, that I think about a lot, that I've engaged in a lot, and that I know we can do much better than we do. And that is in terms of athlete transition. And when I say that, think about it at all levels. I'm talking about athletes. If the last game you play in sport is your high school championship game, there's a transition that takes place that you've now got to focus on the rest of life and figure out what you're going to major in college, that sort of thing. But there's also the professional athlete. People think about that a lot. And Jackie Robinson is the one that famously said that athletes die two deaths, when they retire and then when they actually die. So what we've been trying to do is begin to do with the NFL, with Adidas, with others, some research to find out what's the best way to intervene, what's the best way to try and educate these men and women as these transitions take place. How do we make sure that someone that wants to, for example, if they haven't done a completed degree, what's the best way to help them figure out how to do that? For someone that wants to, that's played Major League Baseball and now they want to be a park director, what's the best way to help them get certified to do that? So to begin to do the research for those kinds of things, and then to set up a portal for these men and women to get on with the next phase of their life. And one of the great things about Arizona State is there's been a lot of work done in that area here with people in the military. And if you think about people that transition and people that have identity-focused lives, I am a soldier and I am going to protect my fellow soldier and we're going to win this battle. And the athlete, not to compare at the same level, but different and worth comparison. Mm-hmm. I'm going to win this game and I'm going to do this for my teammate. They're so single-focused, but what do you do when that's over with? What do you do when you have the loss of that focus in life, and how do you help people transition out of it? So we're learning a lot from the military as well on how to do that. So I say, I could have gone a lot of different ways in terms of what's important out there, but this is one that sat out there for a while that I've been involved in, that teaching different types of transition programs at Wharton, doing it individually with leagues and teams. And we've been kind of stepping back here, thinking about and trying to do the research to figure out how to do all these things the right way.
I think it's very ambitious. Yeah. No, it's very ambitious. I think that's fascinating because I've spoken to student athletes all across the country in different college classrooms. And I've also spoken with many ex-military who are trying to transition into sports careers. And one of the things I'm always fascinated by is that they don't seem to often realize the skills that they've gained from what they've already done, right? They've learned time management, leadership skills, discipline, maturity, all these things that people in the sports industry who are hiring always tell me they want. And so it's almost like I often have to convince athletes and military members that it's not over for them. They can still be involved in this, and actually they're a great fit for it.
That's exactly right. I think the more you understand the skills that you have, and I think there is some understanding. Somebody has been a team captain, realizes they're a leader, but as you said, how do you transfer that skill to running an office, to being the regional manager of Home Depot or something like that?
Right.
You know, how do you do that? And then how do you get employers to understand that how to do that and to take somebody on and to flick that switch and make it work in that new setting?
It's as a person who was in charge of hiring when I worked in the sports media, I think it's fascinating that more people don't look for that. More people don't see leadership skills and those soft skills as something that is harder to teach, and that we can teach somebody, you know, the actual day-to-day of a job, and yet teaching them discipline and maturity and leadership and all those other things is actually harder. And if somebody has that, that's an advantage. But again, that's maybe my own naive side of things.
No, but I fully agree. So the two of us are very naive.
Okay, good.
So I think that's absolutely right.
We can be partners in our naivete. I like that.
Right.
So the Institute clearly has an innovative edge. You listed a lot of the different research projects that you're starting to get into, everything from training methods to economic impacts to sports facilities. But you also personally, and I'm imagining as part of the Global Sports Institute, have a deep focus on societal issues, activism, race, diversity, gender, and more. I think these are the conversations we need to be having more often, because I think they frame our future. Let's start wide and work our way back in. In your view, are we making greater progress as a society on issues of race and gender as they relate to sports and inclusion? Or are the victories still kind of few and far between and just better publicized because we have more channels to distribute what's happening out there?
Well, I always think it is a realist, and if you take these things factually, there's certainly been progress in sport. And you know, the Jackie Robinson moment, sort of all these things have happened in sport that, as you allude to, are highlighted broadly. The idea that there's a Rooney Rule that has helped increase the number of people of color that are head coaches in the NFL, that gets attention, where if in fact IBM or some other great company institutes a program, it may appear in a column in the Wall Street Journal, maybe.
Right.
But probably more likely in their annual report, you'll be able to read about it. So there is a different level of focus that takes place with sport. It is interesting. You know, if you think about sport, you think about the visuals that you do get and the places where people feel so good about how things have changed. It is largely on the field of play. It usually is. Look at the number of African Americans that are playing in the NFL and NBA now, as opposed to the way it was in the 50s and 60s. Look at the number of head coaches, at least in the NBA, being problematic here and there in the NFL. And people, you know, when we give hockey a pass, I mean, you know, hockey is you know, it's in some ways more global sport, and not, you know, a lot of reasons why hockey looks the way that it does.
Right.
But across all the sports at the highest levels, sport looks a lot like the rest of society, especially on the league side and the front offices of teams at the president level on up in ownership. So it is reflective of society in a way, and does give us a visual to think about. But there is a disproportionate in terms of the on-display personnel, the people that are playing the games. And the one place where, you know, people pause a little bit and say, well, I don't know, is baseball, where there's actually been a decline in the number of African Americans, but an increase in the global participation, increase in the Latinx population that's playing the game. So, you know, maybe that's more reflective of what the world really looks like. So that's another way to think about that sport as well. And I also always tell people, too, again, just to kind of think about your question, is it reflective of society? Is it important that African Americans are playing baseball? Is it important that number increases or decreases or whatever it is? And I always say what's important is that there's the opportunity to play and that the resources are available to play if any group wants to play.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense. I've noticed, too, that in our world where we're working on, you know, helping people get their sports career going, and I'm seeing all the different jobs that we have out in the marketplace, I see a lot more opportunities for careers in diversity and inclusion. I recently had Vincent Pearson, who's the manager of diversity and inclusion for minor league baseball, on the show. And he and I talked a lot about this, that there's a new field almost of opportunity in this realm, and they're doing incredible things and making great strides. But it almost seems like a lot of those concepts and ideas come about after a terrible mistake, you know, or a terrible reaction to something, or something happened at a stadium, or whatever it may be, is that there's a very reactive approach to race and inclusion. Are we getting, or how do we get to a point where it's more proactive, where we're fixing the problem before it happens, or we're not just overreacting to things in the moment? Is that even a possibility?
I think so. And I think what you pointed out is what will get us there, will make us all better. And that is that there are people in position in these enterprises now, at these leagues, at many teams, where this is their job. It is to be focused on these diversity and inclusion issues, so that they are looking around for best practices. They are looking around for tools so that these measures become ingrained in the organization. I'm old enough where I remember, and you do too, where before there was the phrase diversity, it was equal opportunity.
Yep.
And then shortly after there was diversity, people realized, well, diversity is, you know, probably going to happen. It's really the inclusion part that we need to add on there. So diversity and inclusion, yep, became a big piece of the conversation. So it's an evolution. And it's, again, everything we've talked about, it's been forward motion. I think that's part of the forward motion, is to put these pieces in place. We know a lot more than we did 10, 15, 20 years ago about how to do these things. So we make great, great progress. And it really is, in a lot of places, depends on the level of priority that leaders of these organizations put on this issue once all these pieces are in place.
Well, that's an interesting thing, is I wonder often, are teams doing enough to support the athletes? And we've seen the Utah Jazz, and there's just a couple examples out there recently. The Utah Jazz ban a fan for life after he made derogatory remarks to Russell Westbrook. But then we see the Boston Celtics give just a 2-year ban to similar behavior directed at DeMarcus Cousins. We see U.S. soccer paying its female athletes way less than the male athletes. And we see all these different issues that come up all the time, and yet I feel like the burden is on the teams and the organizations to do a better job and leading the way with their actions. And yet there seems to be so much inconsistency in that realm.
You're right. And it's interesting. I mean, you think about some of the things that you're talking about, derogatory remarks toward players, those sorts of issues. You know, again, 10 years ago, probably more of the conversation to the player would be, just brush it off. So the idea that actual steps are being taken is a new day. You know, are these the right steps? Are these the right ways to do it? I think that remains to be seen. But it's the players have successfully put themselves in a position, and they've said with great vigor, you know, we're people too. This is impactful to us. We don't need these things to happen to us. Some action needs to be taken to prevent these things from happening. So, and it's kind of this, or again, a reversal of what we've seen in the past from, Ron Artest or somebody going in the stands as a player, to the flip version, players reacting in most cases in a much more subdued way and looking for action to be taken after the fact against the fan that's acted wrongly. I think you raised the issue about equal pay for the U.S. Women's National Team in soccer. That to me has been one of the slowest moving transitions that we've had, and one that's been really has kind of exposed the difficulty in our society to understand that some things should just be done, that we need to move rapidly when we realize there's a wrong taking place. And all the facts there point to the idea of equal pay for, and some people would argue for even more superior performance.
Right.
And where there's not economics that dictate there should be any differential in terms of attendance and marketing dollars and all that sort of thing. So there's really no excuse there. The more difficult conversations come at WNBA, NBA, the more difficult conversations come with women's basketball in college versus men's basketball.
Right.
Those are more difficult, only to the extent of no, there should be equal pay. And the questions that come to mind is how do we better market the women's version of these games to raise the standard so we can see the same thing we see with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team.
What's your vibe on social media? I have this love-hate relationship, and the fact that I love the fact that athletes are more accessible and they have a platform for themselves to broadcast their voice and be heard, to connect with the fans, to criticize anything, presidents, policies. They can be seen as a person rather than just a jersey. But on the flip side, there's also an opening up to anonymous attacks, hurtful words, a very vocal hatred. What's your kind of take on the opportunity versus the cost or the risk of social media and how it's growing in our society?
Well, as I say, you know, the horse is out of the barn. I mean,
right.
It's there. And I think the more difficult times come when teams, you know, ban the use and leagues that, you know, in some instances, you know, don't do it in the dugout and that sort of thing makes sense. And it's, you know, the game's in motion. So, yeah, you should be focused on the game and not about, trying to increase your number of followers and that sort of thing. So I think it is a part of society. Most teams now, most leagues now have some version of a training conversation with the players to get them on board to understand the things that can go wrong. So, yeah, I think we've had vast improvement. And I think it's just, again, this is another issue where it's just they want to be part of society too. And for them too, this is a place where they can monetize themselves. And maybe in the long run, but it is brand building if done correctly. So, you know, I think it's for the most part a positive thing that exists. I think, where everybody, no matter who you are, high school kid, or middle school kid, 80-year-old person, everybody needs to regulate the time they spend on that activity.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. So you've been a professor for a very long time. You've taught and you've been around some of the most connected intellectuals in the world of business and in sports. And now as part of the Global Sports Institute, you're around incredibly forward-thinking people all the time. You've taught a lot, but what are some of the most important things you've learned from some of the other people that you've surrounded yourself with?
I can tell you the great things that I've learned from some great bosses along the way and some great coaches along the way, and people that I've heard great lessons from that I try to follow. Two coaches, one that I spent some time with as I was leaving Stanford, and then another that I just met along the way and just love the things that he writes. So Bill Walsh unfortunately came as I was leaving Stanford.
Oh.
But the thing the guys told me about him that I've heard him say, and then I know Dusty Baker pretty well, and Dusty kind of echoes this, and you could see Dusty when he was managing do this. It's you've got to treat everybody as an individual and understand they're individuals, and you can't use a universal style. And I apply this to management on everybody. And the things that he's able to get out of players individually, because he would, you know, you yell at some, you put your arm around others, you look for what that person needs, as opposed to, you know, kind of the stereotypical kind of image of a, you know, Lombardi or, you know, PJ Carlissimo or whoever it might be. I mean, those kinds of things are pretty interesting. I think, you know, and tied into that, the whole John Wooden kind of thinking too, that you give people everybody everything that you can, and then you let them do the right thing. I mean, Dungy, you know, more than anything else, his emphasis is on the little things are important. So all the little pieces, the details are important. So it drives me crazy to no end when people aren't focused on the little pieces. They're trying to, you know, make a big accomplishment right away as opposed to pulling the little things together. The other thing about Dungy that everybody that I know that's been associated with him appreciates is and Peter Uberoth, who I worked for the LA Olympic Committee, had the same kind of philosophy in a different sort of way. They both had this concept that was essentially work smart, not long. Work smart, not long. That you don't need to be in there all day and all night. But while you're there, get it done in a way, and that family and other parts of your life remain important no matter what your task is. So those are just some of the kinds of things that I think about in trying to operate. We've grown this little institute from a couple of people. Now we're up to, I don't know, 11 or 12 people in here. So I try to think about those things as we build the institute.
I think that's great advice. And I think it's something that we all should listen to and hold tight. I feel, and maybe I'm biased because I've worked in the sports industry for 20 years now, but I always have felt like sports deals with issues first, and it's almost a lens into the future. Like, we see things play out in our little microcosm and then get tackled as a society at large. With that in mind, what are you kind of seeing now? What are the trends telling you now? And where do you think that we'll be as a sports society in the next 5 to 10 years? Are there going to be any dramatic shifts, or does it feel as though we're in a kind of consistent leveling right now?
Well, to me, the two big trends to which I don't think anybody can figure out exactly what's going on. And the two big pieces are gambling, betting, and the lack of need for live gate, live attendance. And I don't know what this means. I mean, so does that mean we're all going to be sitting in our living rooms betting on games going forward? And I think the recent news is that Fox now has a betting app that they're going to be putting out there. So really, it's tying those two together. So I don't know where we're headed with that. So it tells me that we are headed away from the idea of going to the ballpark and enjoying the game, and then people that are gambling are kind of in dark corners somewhere. So it's interesting to think about where we are headed in terms of what constitutes successful sport. And on the, you know, kind of highlighting that for those that have not watched, is this whole esports place, the idea of watching people play on your computer screen or your device. And, you know, only occasionally may you go to a venue to see that live. So that's kind of what's out there. But, you know, I don't think we get away from the basics of baseball, football, basketball, hockey, and all, you know, kind of all the standard games that are out there and the way people have enjoyed them.
It is fascinating. When I first came up in the industry as a sports producer for CNN Sports Illustrated, we were nervous back in then. This was 1996. And I remember being nervous then because they were talking about people being able to produce their own live events through their TV. Like, that was the trend that everybody was talking about. Like, if people are going to be able to pick their own camera angles and do their own thing. And we're all sitting there thinking we're going to be out of a job, you know? And so it's interesting that this conversation about people, you know, the better TVs get and the better all the technology gets, that less people go to the actual events. It feels like this conversation has been going on for a really long time, but it is something, it's like the biggest threat to the industry in a lot of ways.
Right. No, absolutely. And we'll see where it all goes. I think none of us has a grasp of what technology is next. When I was at Wharton, we had a you know, it's actually pre-internet takeover. So this is the early 90s. We had a group of sports executives. We were doing these roundtable kind of closed door sessions with top level people. These were really some top folks. And we had one team president slash owner was in the room. And then we had a professor who was sort of a futurist. He was talking about this, the possibility that some kid in Norway could capture your live feed and transmit it to everybody, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it.
Yeah.
And this executive was like, oh, you know, that's impossible, can't happen. And pretty shortly thereafter, yep. The whole idea of, you know, how do you protect that kind of capturing? How do you protect that kind of distribution? And we've seen it over and over again with different technologies that is an issue that sits out there. And it is something that executives have had to think about. Do we mind if people distribute our IP? Does that do good for us? Does that spread the word? Or is that taking away value? So those kinds of issues have been out there for a while.
I think those are fascinating concepts. So you've written 12 books. I want to finish up with this. You've written 12 books, and your most recent is the award-winning Miseducation of the Student Athlete, How to Fix College Sports. There's a lot of discussion that goes on around college sports and all the problems that are happening with it. And part of your argument is that the student part of student athlete is underdeveloped by universities, and too much focus is put on the athlete part, which we know that there's a lot of money to be made off of these athletes that are in college. Do you think, and is your hypothesis, do you come to a conclusion that this can be fixed? Can we fix the big business of college sports? Because it seems like the money is so high now that they're so motivated by the revenue that comes in that it's almost, I worry it's past the point of being fixed.
Yeah, and you're not alone. So my conclusion is we can certainly be better. And whether or not it can be fixed completely, I think that is a fool's errand, because there will always be people, as long as there is an opportunity to do so, there will always be people that cheat, that make under the table payments, that will, with this gambling thing, that will do. So there's all kinds of things that could go wrong, but we can certainly move to make things better. And a lot of what we focus on in the book is the idea of making education a more important factor than it is, allowing the opportunities for a lifetime for an athlete to come back and complete their degree, to have things like an academic boot camp for the athletes in the same way that you have early ball as they come in, to counsel student athletes on the idea that if you want to go to medical school, then let's put together a 6-year plan as opposed to trying to do the impossible and do it in 4 years, the near impossible. So the idea of being more realistic about how to be successful, the idea of, you know, as I think more and more athletes understand, and it was my story that I said initially, that, you know, guess what? You're probably not going to be one of the ones to make it to the highest level. You're going to have to do something else. So we're going to compel you to think about that and think about the best path to get there. So that's a lot of what I think about. Are we ever going to be perfect? No. And the other factor too, I mentioned kind of the corruption and opportunists and that sort of thing. Well, the other problem, which is, it's a shame to say it's a problem, is that there are too many kids like me that are dreamers and could not imagine that their dream is not going to happen, that they're not going to be successful. The great Dr. Harry Edwards, a sociologist from UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. He's really captured a phrase that's been out there for a while, but he says it best related to the idea of athletes and dreaming. He says, you know, all you guys and women, you need to dream with your eyes open. You need to have the awareness these things might not happen, and you need to be looking ahead to what realities may be available for you if they don't.
That's a really great saying. And it's also important to know that, as you said earlier, making the people in sport better, making sport better and make the world better as a result. You're not saying perfect, right? We're never going to hit perfection, but to get better. I mean, we can always strive.
Does it make us pessimists?
Well, no, yeah, I think it's honest.
Thing if we did, but yeah, don't let fantastic get in the way of
exactly.
Pretty good.
Exactly. It's like we can always strive to be better and to make positive results. It doesn't always have to be perfect.
Right.
Kenneth, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a fascinating conversation. It's so nice to know all the things that you guys are focused on at the Global Sports Institute and the progress you've made and the things that you're going to do in the future and the way you see things developing. It's such a fascinating conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Kenneth Shropshire for coming on the show. Such an honor to have him on. He has such a vision for the industry and seems to always be ahead of the curve. He has a deeper understanding of what is most important to the future of our industry. Such a powerful ability to be able to see that. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, share with your friends, post a nice review wherever you listen. Every little bit helps. So thank you again for listening. All right, time to get back to work.